All right, I'll just get started. Thanks, Mike and Shelley, for the invitation. I'm really sorry I can't be here for more than a week. I've had a great time in the last couple days. So I'm gonna. I've sort of taken a point of view of. I have a sort of long general introduction that I often give that I've just included here. So hopefully it won't get too bogged down in that. But I thought maybe it would be really good to have that sort of length of general introduction. Anyway, so I'm from University of Iowa, and I'm practicing for what might come of me at the University of Iowa, because we might actually be going to the. For those of you following the news, we hired a new CEO of, and we're worried that he might change the name of us to University of Iowa Inc. And some logos that a company in town maybe came up with as possible logos for our new corporate university. Anyway, those of you who want to talk to me about this at the beach party tonight, I'll be glad to do that. Okay, on to reality here. So I'm going to talk about. Work that's been ongoing for actually quite a number of years. This is more or less my current lab, although there's a couple more people now. Almost all the work has been done by my now very recently departed lab manager of 8 years, Cindy Toll, been involved in a lot of things. But most of the work I'm going to talk about today that Mike's familiar with and that really is the project that I'm trying to sort of wrap up while I'm here, at least get it 90% along the way, is work from former graduate students Banu and Art, who also met in my lab, are now married and have a kid. So they've been practicing meiosis as well. If I have some time, and if you're interested, and if I don't have time, I'd be happy to talk about this stuff. Some stuff from graduate student in my lab, Elizabeth Savolkol, on the evolution of meiosis in a diverse group of fungi, and some pretty interesting work that's ongoing in collaboration with David Mark Welch on rotifers, including dull-eyed rotifers and monogonant sexual rotifers. And then I probably won't have time, but I give a little bit of advertisement to my colleague at University of Iowa, Maureen Neiman. We have actually an ongoing project on asexuality and genomics of a group of snails. So anyway, those are possibilities if people want to hear about it later. So I'm going to frame this up, and apologies to those of you who might have heard parts of this before, but anyway, so I'm going to frame that. I sort of think about this sort of along these sort of big questions. Framework, and the questions are, when did meiosis arise? How did it arise, in particular, from what prior functions did it derive? Because we know that evolution doesn't work from scratch. It reuses existing things, and meiosis is a derived feature in cellular life within eukaryotes at some point. So given that it did arise, how has it evolved? How has it changed over time? So has it stayed exactly the same? Of course, the answer is no, but how has that changed? And I'll probably touch on this if I have time, but I'm mostly probably focused on these things today. One of the things about that really is the focus of my lab is, can meiosis be lost? And this is the main focus of the rotifer work, and to some extent the snail work and other asexual organisms, is it possible to be a eukaryote and actually lose meiosis? In the long term. In the short term, the answer is, of course, yes. But this is sort of the career question, which is, what are the consequences of this meiotic evolution for this sort of bigger question, which is a deep question in evolutionary biology, which is the maintenance of sex. Why maintain sexual reproduction in the face of the much more simpler way of doing it, or not doing it in this case, asexual reproduction? So those theories pervaded evolutionary biology for quite a long time, actually. So there's a number of theories for maintaining sexual reproduction, and I call them the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so the good is sort of the standard one that you might hear. Increased variation is beneficial adaptation, and Fisher sort of extended that to talk about bringing good mutations together. The bad, and we talked about Muller the last couple nights. So Muller, which is that deleterious mutations accumulate in the absence of sex in asexuals. So that's Herman Muller with an IU connection. And then what I call the ugly, which is sort of the idea of sex as a sort of way of sort of keeping up with a changing environment. Red Queen and the special case that of parasites that Bill Hamilton is quite well known for, but others have worked on as well. So the good, the bad, and the ugly. So these are ideas for, given that sex exists, why keep it around? And these are not mutually exclusive hypotheses. So this is sort sort of the general backdrop for sort of the evolution of sex literature that you might see. But I'm really more interested in the origin ideas. So where did it come from? How did it come about? So my talk, I'm going to spend a little bit of time in the introduction talking about eukaryotic phylogeny, with the question sort of being, when did sex and meiosis evolve, and what is the phylogenetic distribution of meiosis? My lab, in the last 15 years or so, we've been developing this idea of molecular markers for sex, that is, genes that are specifically involved in meiosis, and then tracing their evolutionary histories as a way of measuring both the birth and evolution of sex, and also later on the presence or absence of sex in organisms. And there are some genes that we'll talk about. So we started out with some genes that are obviously have homologs in prokaryotes, RecA, et cetera. So eukaryotes have a bunch of genes that are involved in meiosis. And the main core of what I'm going to talk about, and really has been the focus of my lab for a number of years, which is this so-called phylogenomic inventory, so of this meiotic machinery. So who has what genes? What components of meiosis are present amongst diverse eukaryotes? Where did the genes come from? And then how did meiosis arise and subsequently evolve? So these kind of inventories that we initially focused on a diverse set of assemblage of organisms of protists, and we started, and I'm going to tell you a fair bit about our starting work, which was on these presumably early diverging organisms like Giardia and Trichomonas as exemplars, and if they're the earliest branches, they might provide us particular insight into this process, but also expanding to all the major eukaryotic lineages, for which now we have a genome basically for all the major eukaryotic lineages. And time permitting, and I doubt there will be, but if there is, I'll talk a little bit about then using this natural history, this inventory, if you will, as a sort of tool, as a toolkit, really to go into organisms that we don't know are having sex and ask whether we can find the parts, if you will, and thus maybe have some provide us some knowledge about their ability to have sexual reproduction, maybe in a kind of closeted kind of way. So Deloid rotifers are sort of the sort of classic test case, and this gets to that question I mentioned before, which is has meiosis been lost, and can meiosis be lost? Okay. Any questions so far on context? Great. So this is the yin and yang in sex, and the reason why I show this for sort of two reasons. One is to emphasize that when most biologists are talking about sex, they're usually talking about this part. They're talking about the getting together of gametes, or the acts that lead to the getting together of gametes, okay? And so it turns out that this process, this fusion process, is actually an important part of sexual reproduction, of course, but it's really this process, meiosis, that is the other side of that equation. Now, when you, as a molecular biologist and as an evolutionary biologist, if I want to study something that's over a few billion years of evolution, which is the sort of history of eukaryotes, I want to pick some things that are relatively conserved across that continuum. And it turns out that the processes of fusion are actually quite less well conserved than the processes of meiosis. So it turns out that the genes involved in meiosis are highly enough conserved to be compared across a few billion years of evolution. In fact, some of the fusion processes, the getting together of gamete-gamete-gamete interactions, stuff like that, is actually among some of the fastest evolving stuff in eukaryotic cells. So we aren't really focusing on this part, but obviously it's super relevant to thinking about sex. So, and the other thing is, of course, that the evolution of meiosis per se is also interesting on its own. So I'm sort of mixing it up by including both evolution of sexual reproduction, but also the evolution of meiosis per se, which is, I guess, the focus of my talk today. Okay, so of course I probably don't need to say this, but sexual reproduction is predominant reproductive mode amongst most eukaryotes. And when I say predominant, it's predominant in the sense that most organisms do it at least some of the time. Okay, widespread, but also asexual reproduction, and maybe surprisingly to some, is actually quite widespread across eukaryotes. It's present among all the major kingdoms. So there's some Deloid rotifers, there's some marine snails, it's in fish, it's, you know, various stick insects, etc. And so it's quite widespread and well known, but it's generally not considered to be a successful long-term reproductive strategy. In other words, there are not clear cases of what we call ancient asexuality, but I'm going to go through some putative ones here in one second here. So there are some so-called ancient asexual lineages, so I should maybe have quotes around that. And these are lineages that seem to be persisting longer than expected, sort of on the order of millions or multiples millions of years. under these ideas of the maintenance of sex. So the idea is that they seem to be persisting for longer, and they're widely distributed. So ambystoma, orbated mites, 100 to 200 million years, some fungi that maybe have been persisting for even longer, a fern, and this is one that's going to be a starring player in what I'm going to talk about. So meet Giardia. I hope you haven't met him before. Have you met Giardia? I'm not going to ask. You know people that have. Everybody says, oh yeah, I have a friend that met Giardia. In any case, so these are organisms for which they've not known to have a sexual cycle, and they may have persisted for a long, long period of time. And so it's, yeah, go ahead.
So what do you mean when you say longer than expected? What is it?
Well, and maybe Mike can say something about the theory here, but the idea is that under those various theories of mutational meltdown, et cetera, that the idea is that organisms shouldn't be able to persist for all that long asexually in the absence of these various positive processes that go on with sex. So the theory isn't super clear. So given that this is a quantitative audience, maybe I'm being a little bit too squishy here. But these are sort of on the edges of the distribution of reality for sure. There's no precision. The other thing is there's no precision about actually both the age of the organisms and whether or not they're actually having sex at all, which I'm going to tell you. And in some cases, we find evidence for them having the ability to have sex in some organisms. So, okay. It's a little bit being provocative with those, yeah. Any question? All right. So given that, and I've been using this slide for many, many years, and it's very kind of neutral with regard to the tree of eukaryotic life. So this is a tree of eukaryotes, and what I've shown here are various groups of eukaryotes, many of which maybe you haven't even heard of, but it's mostly comprised of protists, so single-celled eukaryotes with various names, and mostly, of course, animals, fungi, are mostly sexual. So the idea here is to sort of say, well, what is the distribution of sex? So mostly we don't know. In some cases like Giardia and things like that, we don't know of a sexual cycle. So people have actually looked at it and haven't found it. So the evidence comes from either, in some cases, people have gone and done some population genetics and find evidence for mixture, or they direct observation, they catch them in the act. Okay, so those are the kinds of evidence that you can get, but the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. And so does that mean they're asexual, which some people might say, or are they just having covert sex that we haven't seen yet? Okay, or infrequent sex, infrequent and covert. Okay, so simply observation hasn't been very satisfying in terms of figuring out who's doing it. And you see a lot of minuses, a lot of question marks.
What is a minus?
So the minus, in my mind, means people have actually looked reasonably hard. So these are like diplomonads, for example. People looked really hard for sex. So question marks mean, my assessment was that the literature can't say one way or the other. At least people haven't directly looked for it in many of these cases, right? So yeah, the minuses could be question marks too, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm going to show you that some of the minuses are actually pluses later. Okay.
Has anyone done a study on linkage disequilibrium and isolates of GRD?
Yeah, I'm going to show you that. I'm going to show you that. It wasn't me, but it was another group. Yeah. So I'm going to back up to about the time when I was a graduate student, and this was the tree of life that was sort of the way that people were thinking about when I was a graduate student, which is the three kingdom based on small Soviet ribosomal RNA, two flavors of prokaryotes, and they were called archaebacteria and eubacteria, not archaea and bacteria, and eukaryotes. And one of the things you can see from this is that first of all, the animals, plants, and fungi are sort of twigs on this tree, and that all of these organisms are represent a majority of the phylogenetic diversity of eukaryotes, and these are all protists. Okay. The other thing that you might notice is that these are these three branches, so diplomonads, trichomonads, and microcaryotes. So these are These are organisms that that had a big impact on how we have thought about the evolution of eukaryotes in the last couple of decades. And we've actually, turns out we've actually changed our mind about them. But anyway, so there's some pictures. So there's a Microsporidian, there's a Trichomonad, and there's Giardia again. Okay. And what was interesting is that these organisms were on these trees and on some other molecular trees were the earliest branches on the eukaryotic tree of life. Okay. The other thing about them is that they were missing a bunch of stuff that we had sort of thought were important to defining a eukaryote. So they weren't known to have mitochondria. My PhD work, they weren't known to have introns. They weren't known to have other aspects that we sort of think are sort of important eukaryotic characteristics. Plus, they were early branching, and they weren't known to have sex.
Okay. Can you mention how long ago you think that branch is? Are there quantitative estimates?
Well, okay, so ribosomal RNA does not evolve in a clock-like manner, probably. That's number one. The earliest evidence for a eukaryote in the fossil record is on the order of 1.4 billion, okay? Now, the root of the tree is around 3.6 billion, the first evidence for cells, and I think that's largely geochemical, biogeochemical. And I think the first microfossils are on the order of 3.4. Is that about right? Does anybody follow that literature? So there's somewhere between 3.5 and 1.5 eukaryotes arose. So what happened along here? Okay. One thing I don't want to get stuck on this slide because this is a biased sort of view of eukaryotic evolution. I'm going to tell you in a moment. But the interesting thing is that this led a bunch of us to think about, okay, wow, these are like the missing links of eukaryotic evolution. Okay. Because they're sort of almost eukaryotes. That was what led us to think about it. And I worked on intron evolution, and there was this sort of idea of introns early, introns late, but then I transitioned to work on a meiosis. And so this would suggest that meiosis evolved late. So we're going to call this meiosis late. Okay? They didn't learn to have sex until sometime later during eukaryotic evolution. Okay? That's just... Right, I'm going to tell you two things, right? So one thing is that maybe these are early branches, number one. Microsporidia, as it turns out, are actually misplaced on this tree. They're really badly misplaced. They're actually super-derived fungi. So they're already out of the question. So now I'm going to fast forward a few years, but it turns out this is now molecular tree. It's actually a few years, almost a decade old, but things haven't changed actually that much since this view. So now this is actually more or less the current view of eukaryotic evolution, which are these five or six, depending on who you ask, supergroups of eukaryotes. So opisthokonts, animals, fungi, and some protists, plantae, plants, and some protists. Some protists, right? So mostly still protists, but they're starting to clump together in major groups, okay? Note that the resolution at the base is not clear. That actually remains to be true. Where the root is unclear. There's some thoughts about it, but again, not resolved to my mind. But there's still some, there's something that happened between prokaryotes and eukaryotes, okay? So this is still more or less the point of view that exists today, with some details changed, but mostly they all eukaryotes fall into one of these major groups, supergroups. And instead now it led me and others to sort of start thinking about this idea. So maybe meiosis early, meiosis and sex evolved here, and I'm going to show you some data quite soon that actually demonstrates that this is probably true. Okay, so this is a comment from my colleagues Andrew Roger and Alistair Simpson. The last common ancestor of living eukaryotes now appears to have been a complete eukaryotic cell. It had a nucleus, ER, and Golgi, and underwent mitosis and meiosis. Now, when they wrote this, they were aware of some of the data that I was gathering, but I'm going to show you some data that aren't published that actually I think fairly well demonstrate that this is true about meiosis. Okay. Back to this ribosomal RNA tree of life, just for fun. So there's that tree I just showed you. Now I'm just taking the eukaryote and laying it on its side. So here's Trichomonas, Diplomonas, and Microsporidia. As Mike pointed out, Microsporidia actually belong up here with fungi. So they're really badly misplaced on this tree. We're still unclear about relationships here, but this is just to emphasize that most of the diversity here, again, is from protists. So what do we know about meiosis? So here you are with your fungal relatives, right? So animals and fungi, And this is just to give you a point of view of what we know about how meiosis works. Okay, so mostly what we know about how meiosis works comes from animals and fungi. Okay, so there's a number of model systems for which there are is increasing in lots and lots of data, primarily yeast, flies, worms, us, mice, etc. So most of what we know about how meiosis works comes from now a limited phylogenetic set of organisms, increasingly from plants, which are actually quite distant in under any scheme, right? So but most of the model systems about meiosis actually are sort of in this narrow phylogenetic range, okay? So what I wanted to be able to do in from the point of view of looking at the origin and evolution of meiosis is to take what we know about how meiosis works from these sort of more recent derived model systems and then spread it over the tree of life, tree of eukaryotic life, okay? And so the way that I did this is that, well, first of all, what I was doing was using degenerate PCR to clone and sequence genes. We more or less stopped doing that. Now we're actually, circa about 2005, we had started having enough genomes that we could just start doing bioinformatic analysis of genomes. So here's a tree, it's that same tree I showed you, but it's just sort of splayed out here. Some interesting bits like where the root is, we don't know. But here's opisthokonts, animals, and fungi, amoebozoa. These are all those major groups again. Okay, it's just splayed out. It's just not rooted. Now, so here's animals and fungi, and here's plants. And remember, those are the ones that we know something about how meiosis works from forward genetics and lots of experimental work. And the boxes now, the yellow boxes, represent genomes that were available in 2005. So already 10 years ago, we had a pretty good sampling of genomes across the tree of life, but we were missing sort of some major things, like we didn't have any genomes from this group, we only had one or two genomes from some of these other things. Okay, so if we want to make inferences about how meiosis evolved, we want to actually survey the whole, at least the sampling of the whole set of diversity. But that was pretty good to start with. So this is now the boxes that I showed you from 2005, and I'm just going to show you a time slice for 6 years forward. I actually haven't carried it forward beyond this. So now, there's 2005, now there's 2011. If I put 2015 on there, it would be largely full up with boxes. So at this point, we now actually have multiple genomes from all the major lineages. So basically everything that is known is more or less sampled. Okay? That's a key important point, including things that we don't really know where they fit. Okay. So that's the sort of backdrop in terms of the evolution of eukaryotes. So the next thing I need to talk a little bit about, and I'm going to actually spend some more time sort of midway through talking about sort of meiosis itself. So this is the University of Iowa version of meiosis. One thing to point out is that all the interesting stuff happens in this step, meiosis one. Okay. Meiosis II, as I'll show you, and I'll talk about it in some detail in a little bit, is meiosis II is essentially mitosis. So it's all of this all this stuff in meiosis I, which is the novelty, relative to mitosis. Of course, mitosis is itself the novelty in eukaryotes, but I'm interested in meiosis. And so there's recombination. The prophase of meiosis I is actually where the action is, and that there are many proteins that carry out this business. Many of which are meiosis-specific, and I've already mentioned that the things I'm interested in are meiosis-specific proteins. Okay, just a little bit more information on meiosis 101. So here's mitosis. You got S phase, and then there's one division, the centromeres are split, etc. But there's different stuff that happens in meiosis, pairing, recombination, first division, there's no centromere splitting, second division, there's no replication. I said that really fast. I'm going to go through those details in a minute. But there are key differences between meiosis and mitosis. But essentially, again, this last step here in meiosis II is actually almost identical to what happens in mitosis. So that has really a deep bearing on thinking about the origin of meiosis in the context of mitosis. Okay. I'm going to come back to this slide. I actually have it in this talk again later, but to point out that there's a whole bunch of proteins, and you can't really see the names of them very well, but the green ones are these so-called meiosis-specific ones, and they carry out different jobs. It's not like the meiosis-specific proteins all do one kind of biochemical activity. There are ones that are involved in chromosome cohesion. There's ones involved in creating double-strand breaks. There's ones involved in doing the strand invasion. There's other ones involved in resolving holiday junctions. So these are all separate processes. It's not like you have to just invent one thing that does it. There's a whole series of things that have to happen to carry out the meiosis-specific aspects of meiosis one. Okay?
So can you say a little bit about, about mitosis?
I'm going to go back to that. If you'll oblige me to sort of go forward, actually, I have some slides comparing mitosis and meiosis sort of in detail after a little bit. If that's okay. Remind me if I don't get to it, okay? I think I'll get to it. Okay? All right, so go ahead.
And these are meiosis-specific okay. proteins?
Yeah. So thanks, Shelley, for stopping me. So, I have this slide again, so we can talk about it a little bit more. The green ones are meiosis-specific. The black ones are involved in meiosis. So everything on here is involved in meiosis. The black ones are also involved in mitotic double-strand break repair. Okay. So there's some generalist stuff on here, and there's some specific stuff. So it's modular. Yeah. And that's important, actually, in coming up. Okay? Any other questions? All right. I'm almost done with the sort of introductory stuff, so thanks for bearing with me on this, because I think talking about all these level set of things then allows us to sort of think generally about the whole question. So I'm using meiotic genes to study the evolution of meiosis, and I had some criteria, and I've sort of alluded to some of this already, is the criteria for choosing them are that they're meiosis-specific. They're expressed and or required in meiosis. So And they have to be conserved enough to study. I've already alluded to that. So if I'm going to compare across 2.5 or 2 billion years of evolution, they better be conserved enough over that period of time. In fact, many of them are conserved across all life. So they're conserved at the level of 3.5 billion years of evolution. Okay, so that's good, you know, and there are proteins and genes that are conserved like that, but it turns out that some of these genes are conserved at that level. And then the stuff that Mike is particularly interested in, he's heard about, are these eukaryotic gene duplications. So there's a number of these meiotic markers that actually have evolved by gene duplication, and that turns out to be another interesting aspect. So these two things are required. It turns out these, the gene duplications are actually really helpful and almost, and quite useful for making inferences. So when I started this project about 20 years ago, I sort of said, okay, if I could create the project that's going to work, and I'm God, the most useful of these genes will be present in all species known to undergo meiosis, so required but indispensable, and then absent in all asexual eukaryotes, so use it or lose it. So you need the thing to have meiosis, and if you don't do meiosis, you don't need it and you lose it. That's best case scenario, okay? And so those are sort of general principles to think about. Okay. Turns out evolution violates both of those, perhaps, but they're a good starting point. Okay. A little bit more about those genes and the double-strand break repair. So these are now, there's double-strand break repair, and the molecular process is carried out either in repair or in meiosis, so the same sort of molecular cartoon that's going on with chromosomes. And the gene names now are shown here from yeast. Those are the yeast gene names. And it turns out, as I was saying, there's a set of genes that are used both in meiosis and mitosis, okay? And then there's ones that are specific to meiosis, okay? So there's a generalist set, and there's a specific set. So now you're asking, what are the boxes? Well, the boxes are genes that have evolved by gene duplication. And this was sort of the founding member of my survey, RAD51. It is homologous to REC A. It is the orthologue, in fact, of bacterial REC A, the recombinase in prokaryotes. Archaebacteria have it. It's called RAD A. So it's a generalist. Everybody's got RAD 51. There's a specific version of that's a paralog evolved by gene duplication called DMC1, and it's the REC A homologue that's specific to meiosis. So those are a pair. There's another pair, RAD 54 and RDH 54. These are homologs of the mute S protein, so these are mismatch repair detection proteins. There's a specific version that's involved in meiosis. Okay, and then the boxes that don't have colors in them are genes that don't show up in this column, but actually have another gene in the genome that has a different function, not in double-strand break repair. So these are various ones that have evolved by gene duplication, but their generalist function is not in double-strand break repair. So already a bunch of these, we are pretty clear that many of the meiosis-specific genes have evolved by gene duplication, just based on this alone. Okay? And that already begins to answer the question about where did meiosis come from. There were many existing functions that predate the origin of meiosis that borrowed substantially from those processes by gene duplication. Okay, giving you a little bit of hint. Okay, so I'm going to take you through a little bit historical tour of the way this has gone in my lab as a way of talking about what we've been doing. So this is an early table of this inventory about 13 years ago now. So this is just as I got my lab started. So now the organisms here, so there's some animals, there's some fungi, there's some plants, and there's some protists. Okay, some of these key protists that I'm going to spend some time talking about, Giardia and Trichomonas there on top. Meiosis specific are colored in, SPO11, et cetera. So there are some things to notice here. So everybody has SPO11. SPO11 is a really interesting protein. It creates double strand breaks. It's actually homologous to a topoisomerase. It's a 2-subunit topoisomerase in archaebacteria. In eukaryotes, it doesn't have the other subunit in the context of meiosis. And so it's sort of, you can think of it as an exapted function into this meiosis. And think about this, it actually makes double strand breaks, something the eukaryotic cell does a lot to sort of not have happen. So it's doing something actively that generally is sort of bad. So it's hard to imagine it having another function other than in this sort of create double strand breaks for recombination function. So everybody's got that one. There are other ones that are, so we know that flies and mosquitoes and worms, we know that they have sex. We know that they have meiosis, but yet they're missing some of these meiosis-specific genes. So they sort of fit the other category. So some of these genes have been lost. And in fact, some of them have been lost separately because there's an intermediate taxon right here. So Bombyx has the genes. So we know that in the case of worms and flies, they've lost them separately. And it turns out that these genes have been lost separately many times. And they've been lost again separately in things like Neurospora. So we know that in this case, these genes are probably ancestrally present and have been lost separately in some lineages. So that's sort of one message already. And it violates that one principle I was mentioning, which is that you know, if you need it for meiosis, everybody should have it. Yeah.
Your curiosity was known about the biochemistry since those keep being lost in tandem.
Yeah, you're very, very astute. Turns out, so I'll get back to that in just 2 seconds. When you can already see it with this little of data, you're going to see it. It's going to blare out when you see more data.
The other quick question, yeah. SPO11, you may have said this, what is it doing in the archaebacteria?
It's a 2-subunit topoisomerase. So it actually is, its ancestral function, yeah. So it's the cutter, yeah. Yeah.
Are you going to talk about nucleomorphs at
all? I'm not going to talk about nucleomorphs. Maybe you and I should talk about nucleomorphs as exceptions, perhaps.
Because they presumably don't have.
So I worked on, let's talk about that later, yeah.
What is a nucleomorph?
A nucleomorph is, eukaryotic cells, we're very familiar with endosymbiosis of a prokaryote to create a plastid, but sometimes some eukaryotic cells are actually endosymbionts of other eukaryotic cells. And when eukaryotic cells engulf other eukaryotic cells, they also have a nucleus. And so some of those organisms actually retain a small version of the nucleus called a nucleomorph. Okay, and so it's like a eukaryotic cell enslaved inside of another eukaryotic cell. And so what happens in those, and it turns out they don't do meiosis either. They've lost all this stuff too. So they aren't really a nucleus, but their host cell presumably has all the stuff. So in fact, we've actually looked for those things. So those are kind of interesting sort of exceptional cases that we've done a little bit of work on, but I don't really have any slides on it. Okay, so now that's just sort of the general picture. Our first sort of publication on this was looking at Giardia. So Giardia, remember, was this putatively early branching, not known to have sex, did I forget to mention it didn't have a mitochondrion? Yeah, I did say that. So that whole group of archaeozoa didn't have mitochondria. It turns out Giardia probably had a mitochondrion and lost it. Okay, because there's genes in the nuclear genome that tell us that it had a mitochondrion. So it's mitochondrial genes in the nucleus. In any case, so Giardia also probably had sex, so it's got the meiosis genes. It's missing this pair. These are the mutase homologs. I'm going to come back to this in a second. So it allowed us to do two things. It says, okay, yeah, this is sort of positive evidence for sex. it's got the goods, it's probably doing the deed, that's my line. And it also says that if Giardia is either the earliest branch or among the earliest branches, it would suggest an early origin for meiosis. Now, I'm being a little noncommittal and not saying, you know, basal, but it probably does represent an early branch. So it's at least as early as the divergence of Giardia from the main eukaryotic line. That's what these data demonstrate. And this is getting to Mike's point, is that later some people did some population genetics. It's actually not LD per se. They actually did molecular. They actually did some sequencing and found really great recombination joints. I mean, it's super clear that it's exchange recombination, okay? So population genetics went back and did some of this stuff. And basically, it was two diverse populations that came together, and they could actually do the test. So it was pretty good evidence. People have been looking before and hadn't seen it. So anyway, so that sort of came full circle a little bit. So now this is now the sort of next generation. I don't know if this goes back a little bit less far. So now we've got some more protists, et cetera. Now what you're seeing is, and the next thing I'm going to talk about is this organism, Trichomonas, which is another one of those putative early branches. So here's Giardia. And it seems to be missing a few things. Trichomonas basically has the whole shebang, minus a couple. And it's an early branch. And let's compare, so Trichomonas and Giardia, certainly still are candidates for earliest branches, on the earliest branches, but compare that to us and yeast and aspergillus. So these are, is this 27 or 29? I can't remember. Basically, you know, animals, fungi have the whole set. Trichomonas has almost the whole set. So already we can say is that the genes on this diagram, probably most of them are actually present in the common ancestor of everything here. Now the gaps here are either missing data, I can't find the gene, or they've been lost. And as you noticed, there are a number of cases where things seem to be missing in tandem, right? So here's MSH4 and MSH5. They work in a complex, a heterocomplex, as it turns out. You lose one, you lose the other. HOP2, MND1, so this set, which I think was what you were looking at before, they also work in a complex. So it already told us some stuff about that too, which was also being verified at the, you know, in the experimental side. So we learned something about that as well.
So this is pretty, as you emphasize, this is animal fungi-centric. So when you say, you know, these other guys have the full set,
I mean,
if you started with Giardia and Trichomonas and really knew what was going on there, would humans and fungi have the full set? How do we know what?
There's
the unknown and
I guess it's an interesting. Remember, I started from model systems, right? And so you're sort of doing the backwards question. If the model system by it was Giardia and Trichomonas to start with, and we went looking in humans, what would we think?
Or any of these other?
Well, to some extent. We certainly aren't at saturation with regard to meiosis genes, but man, we're asymptoting. I go to Meiosis Gordon conference, and the number of new genes that people discover that are widely distributed amongst eukaryotes is zooming up. And
yeah, but were those discovered in animals?
Yeah, absolutely. DMC.
People aren't looking at these other lineages.
Not necessarily, but DMC1 was my starter. When that paper came out when I was a grad student, I said, DMC1, that's a Reke homologue. That was discovered in yeast. It wasn't discovered because it was conserved. It was discovered because it was really important in meiosis. And a bunch of those things happened. It turns out many of the ones that are conserved across animals and fungi, which is maybe a billion years, many of those are actually also conserved. Almost all of those are actually conserved in plants and then represents this set. So I actually see your point, but it turns out that we aren't finding any more conserved genes in meiosis between animals and fungi, because if you even just use that criterion, you're not going to, if they aren't conserved between animals and fungi, they're not going to be conserved in protists either.
Why do you say that?
Because animals and fungi share a more common ancestor.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood what you're saying, but it could still be, there could be things that are conserved between plants and Giardia or something.
Yeah, fair enough. But we don't study Giardia meiosis. That's the problem. And I think that was what Mike was getting at to some extent. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one way to think about the question is that maybe Trichomonas could have a more complex regime, and that animals and fungi are a simplified version of the sort of ancestral state, and this approach would be challenged to find that.
Yeah, I hadn't, that's a sort of bottom-up kind of view, and I hadn't really thought of that, so it's like, thanks for that comment. I haven't really thought about that. And it, what it's going to require is that we actually study meiosis in some detail in some protists, which is actually one of the things I proposed as a postdoc, which never happened because it just became very difficult to do. But yeah, we need more model systems beyond the animals, fungi, and plants. That's a given. We need that for everything that we're interested, of the people that are interested in eukaryotic origins. We need that. But it's just not happening. Naegleria sort of seemed like it might be a really good thing, but anyway, that's an aside. Okay, yeah.
Say that a particular gene is meiosis specific, do it mean by they just compare meiosis to meiosis, or
yeah.
Is it possible for those genes actually involved in common functions, cellular function?
It's a really good question, and it's actually, it's a little bit of an Achilles heel for this work. It's not a huge one, and I'll tell you why. When I say that, I mean that in organisms where it's studied, where you can do things like knockouts, it doesn't have a discernible phenotype in anything other than a meiosis, right? Now, one of the problems with this argument that I just made is that those, you know, we haven't done serious like competition experiments, so maybe it could have a small relic function that's actually maintained, that's not meiosis specific, but it would have to be pretty marginal. So at least those stuff in yeast, people have at least done the knockouts, and yeah, they don't do the competitions, but they're certainly, you know, on the level of, you know, let's say at the best 10%, right? I mean, I'm being arbitrary, okay? So for the most part, now it turns out that most of the ones that are meiosis specific in yeast, of the ones that are homologous to those in mammals, if you knock them out in mammals, same deal, right? Most of them also are only expressed during meiosis. Turns out that expression is a little bit loose, so sometimes you can get expression and not function too. So it's sort of a squishy sort of combination of criteria, in which any given organism can violate it. But in general, the idea is that the function is conserved. The meiosis specific function is conserved across a wide variety of eukaryotes, which then suggests that its ancestral function is that. Okay, but that's a really important point. Okay, other questions? All right, moving forward. So remember I said that Giardia was missing this MSH4 and 5, and when we first saw this in Giardia, we thought, oh, this is cool. You know, maybe meiosis evolved early, but maybe there are some aspects of meiosis that came later. Because Giardia didn't have this thing, and MSH4 and 5 is involved in crossover control. So maybe crossover specification and control like evolved later, like it was this add-on feature of meiosis. Well, Trichomonas has it, and maybe Trichomonas is a later branching organism or not, we don't know, so it at least made us ask the question. So Trichomonas has basically all the stuff that Giardia has, plus it has MSH4 and 5, so the meiosis specific's in red now, okay? Right, so MSH4 and 5. So this was the tree we published with the Giardia paper, and so these are the homologs of mutes that are not meiosis specific, so MSH2, MSH6, et cetera. MSH4 and 5 are each other's closest lineages, and these are just animals, plants, and fungi. Okay, no protists. Consistent with that idea that MSH4 and 5 got invented late. Cool, right? Well, Banu, my student, wasn't happy with that, and so went out later and sort of searched through the literature for these and found a whole bunch of protists. And the protists now are in these sort of peach color, and found that a whole variety of protists have MSH4 and 5, plus Trichomonas, which I already told you. So it looks like it just happens to be that Giardia is missing MSH4 and 5. And it turns out MSH4 and 5 have been lost in other eukaryotic lineages as well. So too bad for that. So in addition to all those other genes that we can now place early in eukaryotic evolution, MSH4 and 5 as well. Okay? A little bit more about so this is just for fun. You don't want to stare at this too long. This is sort of where it's going. I actually stopped making these back in 08 because you get way too many taxa, way too many genes. But you can see the kind of data that we're gathering and et cetera. So this was just a figure from Bonnie's thesis. This is an eye chart just to focus your eyes for a second. Okay. One of the interesting things, I was mentioning this at lunch or dinner the other day, I can't remember, is that it turns out that organisms lacking this pair of MSH4 and 5 always encode another protein called MUS81, and actually also this thing called MMS4. It turns out that there's another system for crossover control in eukaryotes, and so organisms that are missing MSH4 and 5 always have this pair. Organisms that are missing this pair always have MSH4 and 5, and some organisms have both. Okay, so this is a case of a kind of redundant system where MSH4 and 5 is sort of maybe the primary player, and that there are two systems operating in terms of crossover control. Okay, so backup, redundant, whatever you want to call it. That's just kind of a cool little story. This is the main show now. Let's see how we're doing on time. I tie my shoe. So now at this point we have focusing on a set of 20 genes, meiosis specific are in color here, and now what we've done is put all the organisms in different colors based on their supergroup. Okay, so there's complete genomes from multiple organisms, or in one case one from all the supergroups. So we have at least one genome from each of the supergroups, and we've got a whole set of genes. Okay, so these are the data. This is a gene that's actually, probably been lost multiple times, DMC1. So you can see it's sparse to some extent. Okay, so them's the data. So if you take those data and then you just crunch these colored groups into just one ancestral taxon based on the presence of a given gene in any of the taxa. Okay, so the presence of the gene in any of the taxa means that it was present in the whole group. Right? Or at least it's present at least in the group, okay? And assuming vertical transmission, right? So it's not exchanging horizontally, which there's no evidence for. Okay, so that's the trick now. We're going to do that. Shrink. Now, so now these are the genes, these are the taxa. Now if it's filled in, that means that the gene is present in at least one of those species in that group. And by this alone, you can say, well, at least 10 were present, 5 of the meiosis-specific ones. In the last common ancestor, meaning they're present in all the lineages. Everybody see how I made that argument? Is if they're present in all the lineages, I don't care who's related to who, they're present in the common ancestor of all of them. That makes sense, everybody? Okay.
How do we know this is an argument?
Okay. I was expecting that. There's first of all, the phylogenetic trees of the proteins themselves, and I'm going to show you this, recapitulate the phylogeny. They're more or less similar to another. So they're not clear sort of discrepancies where a fungus is sticking out from the middle of a plant. Okay, so there's not clear discrepancies. So that's sort of, there's no direct evidence for it. That's number one. Number two is, although there's some discussion in the literature about what the impact of lateral transfer is in eukaryotes, I think the consensus is that it's relatively rare, okay, compared to prokaryotes in any case, and that at least of the ones that are known, they're not sort of among the core machinery, okay. So the last part is maybe a little bit hand wavy. It's really the first part that really makes the big difference. So each individual gene tree sort of looks like every other gene tree, okay. And it looks like what the consensus ought to be of the phylogeny of the organism. So vertical evolution is the null hypothesis, and the data are consistent with it. Is that satisfying enough? Yeah.
Do you have a question whether they have exactly the same function? Like, if you take this ortholog from that other,
yeah,
whether it does exactly the same?
So partly inference, partly weak inference, partly strong inference. So the strong inference part is that we're studied. Now, plants and opisthokonts, plants versus animals and or fungi, that may represent among the deepest divergences in eukaryotes, okay? So it may be the deepest divergence, to be honest. So we're studied. In many cases, certainly the meiosis-specific ones in plants do exactly the same thing as they do in yeast and mammals. I mean, DMC1 does exactly the same thing. SPO11 does exactly the same thing. So the functional stuff we're studied is completely consistent with the inference. And there aren't, in many cases, there aren't other genes, there aren't paralogs of the paralogs doing something alternate. right? So the strong inference is what I just said now about plants versus animals and fungi. The weak inference is that it's usually a single copy, and their phylogenetic trees are consistent with orthology. So orthology sort of predicts, in some way, conserved function. It doesn't demand it, of course. So that's the weak part. So in general, it's harder to imagine a new function in these cases, given that the disparate lineages actually contain the function that we're ascribing to it. That makes sense? Okay, yeah, those are all great questions. So that's summing. And already we can say five of the meiosis-specific genes are in the common ancestor. But we have another. I have another trick. Remember, I said that most of these genes evolve by gene duplication. Okay. So this is the tree. There's an archibacterial homolog. There's a paralog A. Let's call this Rad51. Paralog B. Let's call this one Rad51. Let's call this one DMC1. Let's say. Okay. So meiosis-specific or general. Okay. We know that they evolve by a gene duplication. I'm going to show you some trees in a minute, that the duplication predates all these species. So in this case, even if species 4 is missing paralog A, we know that it had it and lost it because the gene duplication predates. Okay, the fact that it has paralog B and that the phylogenetic tree is of this structure, it means that it had it and lost it because species 1, 2, and 3 have paralog A. Everybody follow that? It's a little bit of a trick, but it works. It's actually quite a strong inference. So we use this now information to then...
Paralog B is crucial for this argument. That
absolutely, paralog B is crucial. And when the duplication occurred is also crucial.
Yes, sure. But
absolutely.
You have to see it in paralog
presence
B.
Of paralog B, yes. Absolutely. If you don't have paralog B, it could be a mess. So now what we've done is done that test and then say... it turns out that if you say that if they have one or the other paralog, doesn't have to be both, then it turns out that we can then sum, and it turns out we can make an inference that all 20 are actually present in the common ancestor, because they either have A or B or both among all the lineages. So that means all of the nine meiosis-specific ones are present in the common ancestor, and it doesn't matter who the deepest branch is. It could be Giardia, it could be plants, it could be Abyssicons. It doesn't matter because it means that those genes were present in the common ancestor of all these things. Okay. Now the question of whether it's a biased set is actually something I'm going to think about a lot because I sort of took it from top down as opposed to bottom up. But at least from this top down approach, the set of genes that have been discovered to be really important in meiosis and conserved are consistent with all those genes already being present in the common ancestor of all these eukaryotes. That's the main message. There's a little trick that we also did for ascertainment, which I won't take time to talk about, but having to do with the ability to discover, et cetera. I'll skip that. Getting to the vertical transmission now, so this is now back to the whole data. It turns out, and this is not a big deal, it turns out, as expected, if you concatenate all these proteins and draw a tree, you get a tree that looks like what you expect a eukaryotic tree of life to look like. That's good. Actually, all the individual ones do, but not very well, because individual gene trees don't really work that well. But when you sum them together, it's actually a pretty damn good tree. And this would have been a super publishable result 10 years ago on eukaryotic tree of life, but now we've got whole genomes for it. But it's consistent with that. Okay. So now I'm going to take it one step further and remind you that all of those genes, so here are the genes again, here are the lineages of organisms. I'm going to now talk a little bit about the gene duplication thing. We use the gene duplication as a way of inferring common ancestry, but now we're going to talk about their origin. Turns out that many of these genes have evolved by gene duplication. So these are all eukaryotes, but the little trees below represent the fact that REC8 and RAD21 are a gene duplication. These are the MUTES homologs here. They're evolved by multiple gene duplications. So many of these actually have outgroups in prokaryotes. So these represent, all of the meiosis-specific genes in this set of data that we've looked at, actually. And I haven't dropped any because they weren't duplicated. So it turns out that given that, basically, all of these meiosis-specific genes evolve by gene duplication. Okay, So, and they aren't just in one category. So these are functions that are in meiosis. So this is a function of the synaptic complex, axial element, cohesins, double-strand break, homologous recombination, crossover. So in all of those different categories of how meiosis works, genes evolve by gene duplication. Either from homo, so let me just give you an example here. Oh, so here's SPO11. So here's SPO11. That's the archaeal homolog, archaebacterial homolog, the topoisomerase. And it actually turns out there are two versions, but that we could talk about that later. It's not a big deal. Or these are the cohesins. That's the mitotic cohesin. That's the meiotic cohesin. Now, we don't know of, of an outgroup, but we know that they evolve by a gene duplication. Same thing here. So they all clearly evolve by a gene duplication, and their distribution in eukaryotes suggests that that gene duplication happened at or before the origin of eukaryotes.
So is that an unusual thing? Like, if you pick some other, like, new process, would you usually find this?
It's the first diverse process that I'm aware of in which this kind of analysis has been done. Now, if you look at other things, and now given this knowledge, you start thinking about other things, you start thinking about, oh, wow, there's lots of gene duplications that founded the origin of the eukaryotic cell. Alpha, beta, tubulins. There's a whole bunch of stuff with spliceosomes that's sort of the same kind of deal, right? So when you take this kind of, and the neat thing and why I'm emphasizing the different functions is that it's a process. It's not just one function. It's a series of functions that at surface are kind of they're related in a pathway, but they aren't actually related biochemically to one another. And so it turns out that...
interesting example, actually, yeah. Which is our rod and cone cells of our photoreceptor cells, they each have a different phototransduction mechanism, and essentially all those genes were duplicated in the common ancestor of vertebrates.
Of vertebrates. So that's a more narrow phylogenetic group, but the same kind of deal, right? Yeah.
What's the alternative hypothesis? Is it de novo origin
or cobbled? So you, one way to think about it is cobbled together from existing functions that get exapted into a new function and then lose their ancestral function. So the one message from this is that there was. So one thing I want you to think about here is how do you get a simultaneous set of gene duplications like this?
I guess what I'm wondering is, are we doing a strong inference here, or is this just affirming the consequent about gene duplication? In other words, it's consistent with gene duplication, but is it ruling something else out?
Is it ruling something else out?
You know, is it really a strong inference or something?
Every one of the meiosis-specific genes that we've studied in this broad survey, right, with a bias of top-down as opposed to bottom-up, have discernibly evolved by a gene duplication that happened early in eukaryotic evolution after the divergence from archaebacteria. So they're all coincident in time. So there are none of the meiosis-specific genes that didn't evolve in that way, that didn't arise in that way.
And your argument slash proof for that is that each of them has a paralog which does something.
Does something else. In some case, works in meiosis, but not only in meiosis.
Now the question is, what something else do these paralogs do?
Yeah.
If you do sort of mirror image between meiosis and paralogs, would it be a group of genes that do something uncertainly?
Right. Well, it turns out that some of them are involved in recombination, right? So many of them actually are involved in this part. So these are REC-A homologs. Okay, so many of them you can trace the recombination, but not all of them, right? These are DNA repair. So I don't think they steal from one process. They're borrowing from a variety of different processes.
Which ones are from Archaea?
Let's see. So this is a variety of things here. So that's the archaebacterial homolog of REC-A, RAD-A. These are sort of convenience. These are archaebacterial homologs here. There are no prokaryotic homologs where there's not anything listed. They're duplicates of each other, but there's not a known homolog in archaebacteria. Now, probably this means that there is a homolog in archaebacteria that we can't find. That's possibly the case, right? So that's an ascertainment problem. This is a... what does Rab7 do? It's part of a polymerase. Anyway, maybe somebody can remind me what Rab7 does. But anyway... they borrow from a whole variety of different functions. So this is actually a eukaryotic set. All the black branches are prokaryotic. Most of them are archaebacterial. So archaebacterial, I think that's actually eubacterial, eubacterial, archibacterial.
I guess my question is whether there are some collaboration only possible after archaea met bacteria.
You know, that's a deep question about the origin of eukaryotes, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the origin of eukaryotes in a second, so maybe we can talk about that in a second.
There's a lot of this going on with the vesicle transport system,
right,
and like the rads and the
right
snares.
It seems like the origin of eukaryotic novelty is driven by gene duplication.
Yeah, and I think you can't rule out, I mean, if there's information's probably erased, but it is possible.
Well, so that's actually my preference. So how do you get a whole bunch of gene duplications that happen simultaneously? Have a genome duplication. Now we're going to talk about meiosis in a second, and you're going to see the connection. Probably you already have, but other people will see it in a second. So let me get to that now. So this is now, those are the data. That's the sort of crux of what I wanted to talk about today. So I've made it through that part. So there's 2 points. The second one I didn't really make, but the molecular machinery evolved early and once, probably. Prior to extant eukaryotes, so it didn't evolve late. So this meiosis late thing was, you know, not true. There's lots of gene duplications and some losses, okay? If there are asexuals, they would be derived from sexual ancestors. So the ancestor of eukaryotes is sexual, and if there are in fact asexuals, they're derived. There's no ancient asexuals that never learned to have sex. There might be ancient in terms of time, but there's not any ones that were ancestrally ancient, like what Giardia was thought to be. Okay, that's gone. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So.
To give you the usual warning, I guess it's about it's 2:37.
11:37. Oh, perfect. That's actually perfect. So then's the data. The next thing I want to talk about was the thing that's maybe Rick was wanting me to talk about, which was what is the relationship between mitosis and meiosis. Okay. So, any questions on the stuff up till now, and then I'll do some kind of comparisons of mitosis and meiosis.
So, do you think the paralogs that the genes were duplicated from, are they close enough to still do gene conversion and influence meiosis that way?
No. The closest pair are RAD51 and DMC1, and they are within any given genome. They're at best 25% identical. So for the most part, the generalist versus the specific ones are actually, they're totally discernible phylogenetically, but their sequences are nowhere near each other at the DNA level. Absolutely. I mean, it's been 2 billion years. So, yeah. But it's an important question about whether or not they can exchange information an obscure function. That would be if they were really close, maybe that's what's happening. Yeah. Okay. So now I wanted to talk about, and I've just added this in. I've actually thought about this a lot, but I added this in for this group just to think about it. So what is the relationship between meiosis and mitosis? There was this really nice paper, and I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. So it's really nice paper, and I guess Mike, you must have commented on it because you're actually thanked in the acknowledgments. But in any case, this paper came out from Adam Wilkins and Robin Holiday, where they talked about sort of the relationship between mitosis and meiosis. And so I'm going to use this as a sort of way of talking about this today. I mostly agree with what they have to say. There's some details that maybe I don't, that I'll talk about in a little bit. So again, a reminder of meiosis 101 is that all of the interesting stuff is here. This is more or less equal to this. And they're talking about what is novel here and where did it come from relative to, and their idea is that there already was mitosis and that meiosis 1 was basically an add-on to mitosis. And I think for the most part, all the data are consistent with this, but we'll talk about it, and I'm interested in what your thoughts are. This is another way of looking at it is if you put mitosis next to meiosis is really more like this, not like the Kleckner diagram I just showed you, is that basically this is the new bit here.
Can you comment on reverse meiosis?
On what?
Reverse meiosis. Because, here is the revolutionary part is now the homologous chromosome aligned together first.
Yeah, so maybe it's worth talking about that a little bit. What are the things that are unique? I went by this really fast. You have pairing of homologous chromosomes. You have recombination between those homologs, right? And you have, in the first division, you don't split centromeres, right? So you, there's a what we call monopolar attachment, monopolar attachment on each side, so that when they segregate in meiosis one, they actually the sister set stays together, okay? And the recombinants. And then the other thing, so those are all the things that happen. And then the other thing is that there's no replication here. So those are the four things that distinguish it. But I don't know what you mean by reverse.
Because in actually many organisms, including human, fly, and plants, that there sometimes meiosis can process first separate. Now the first basically meiosis two and meiosis one reverse.
Super rare. Inverted meiosis, super rare. That's called inverted meiosis, and I haven't actually read about it in some time, but it's super rare. It's actually not particularly common. Maybe we should talk about it later. But I mean, it turns out that this general the neat thing about this general diagram is that where studied that whole diversity of eukaryotes, when you look at it, it's actually this process. Now there are some exceptions to meiosis that are sort of terminal lineages of things that are worth studying, but in general, those are exceptions, not rules.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
but in humans?
Yeah, the amazing part, it just published this year.
So okay, well, I haven't seen it, so please send me the data. Okay. Yeah.
The amazing part is, even now, if meiosis two happens first, then it already loses the pairing, right? But that's in the second step, they can still, the fidelity, that because you would expect 50% of the cell just turn out to die because it doesn't go to separate, go to different daughter cells, but it turns out almost 80% still go to the correct direction. I don't know if there are some ancestral relic which can enhance.
I think this is getting to one thing is sort of, this is deep in the meiosis field, what's the relationship between crossovers and pairing? So in some organisms, you need double-strand breaks to actually make pairs. In other organisms, you don't. So the relationship of the details of the pairing, whether you need breaks first and then pairing, or pairing in the and then breaks in the context of the pairs, is all variable. But in general, what's happening is that there's going to be pairing, there's going to be double-strand breaks, and recombination nodules or chiasmata. The order of those events sometimes varies amongst organisms. But I now am following where you're coming from. So that's the sort of general sense. Back to this diagram. I think I spent more time on it before that I probably don't need to do that again. So there's a bunch of players. And so what are the new pieces? So this double strand break thing, and then this sort of interhomolog recombination, and the pairing of chromosomes that happens, and the order of events varies amongst organisms, and then of course the sort of holiday junction resolution, and then you can move on to meiosis two. So this is the main table this is from Wilkins and Holiday now. So where they compared mitotic and meiotic stages, and they have I've emphasized the things that are novel to meiosis. So they're comparing mitosis to meiosis here, and here are the results. So here's one difference, is that homolog pairing and recombination. Now it's interesting they actually put comma, because as I said, different organisms might do that in different order, but those two things have to happen. I already mentioned the centromere splitting, and then no synthesis. They basically recapitulated what I just said, and so then they go on to talk about sort of what the difference is, and they come down to basically say that the difference between mitosis and meiosis is essentially mostly modification of existing things, with the only real novelty is pairing. Right. So that's their point of view, is that it has to do with some of the details. So they sort of think about things as sort of an existing set of functions that already existed in mitosis, and that what do you got to get meiosis? And it's just mostly this homolog pairing is what their inference is. Yeah.
So on the L101, you get the pairing of the chromosomes happens after the duplication. So you only get crossover in one of yours, in one of the two strands you get the crossover. So, why would you not evolve a pairing at the single step, in the first step? If you evolve the pairing and the crossover in the first step prior to the duplication of the chromosome.
Okay.
It seems odd that you should only cross over half of your.
Right. So there's a replication that happens. So this is an interesting question, is why don't you just skip this thing altogether? I mean, essentially what you're saying, can you do it in one step?
Yeah. Why can't you cross over the single chromosomes and then go through mitosis?
Because that's not the solution. But there is a thought that you could get rid of these, right? You could suppress replication at this point, crossover, and then you've got two gametes, right? Each haploid. Why couldn't you do that, right? And they would recombine. That's what you're thinking?
To have the non-resected template there to carry the strands on.
Well, so first of all, this pairing for most organisms is facilitated and enhanced by a SNAP-NEMAL complex, which is actually fairly widely distributed across eukaryotes. Okay, so that one of those genes that I talked about, HOP1, is actually part of the axial element, and it may be the sort of SC. It's actually present in things that don't have SC, discernible visible SC. I think you're absolutely right. So why didn't use this other solution? But it turns out that replication happens here, just like the S phase is the same. In fact, people that have studied S phase in meiosis at the detailed level they find very few differences. Mimi Zolan at Indiana sort of looked at this, and there are very few discernible differences in S phase of meiosis and S phase of mitosis.
Maybe Shelley knows this, but I mean, is it true that only two of the arms participate?
This is
so. Go ahead. I don't know. I would be surprised if along the whole length of the chromosome that it was only two chromosomes that recombined and the other two were left completely.
I think. Well, generally, of course, there's a crossover dropped on each arm. I mean, that's sort of the rule. My guess is that if there was another crossover shown here, it would be 50-50 whether it went between these two or those two. You know, it would be 25% of each possibility. So I don't think that demands that it only be between.
It's not like two chromosomes remain.
The cartoon simplified.
Yeah. Because it's basically the same in every book, that cartoon, that you have two non-crossover. So I don't know whether to take that literally or not.
If there's one crossover, that would be a demand. If there's two, then you're going to get other combinations. You're going to get four combinations.
I mean, one idea is if you have a pre-existing single-strand damage, it's converted to a double-strand damage by the replication. Effectively, there's a gap then across from the damage, the single-strand damage. And then that could be a general cue to recombine here to fix that damage.
Well, of course, this is specified by SPO 11. There's a double-strand break that's dropped here. Actually, there's a bunch of double-strand breaks. This is now details of meiosis. What happens is there's a bunch of double-strand breaks that happen, of which only a few of them mature into chiasmata. Okay, and those are all created by SPO 11 and then resected by another set of machinery, MRE 11, et cetera. And then those are the ones that are sort of the templates for the invasion of strands and then eventual crossing over. But the crossing over, generally, the rule is it's only one crossover per arm.
It's an average.
I'm just saying, in general, it's an average, right? But you know, it's pretty tight. It does, you know, the average, you know, the variance doesn't go much over, you know, it doesn't go to two, let's say. It's actually, that's an interesting aspect of it. Where the question was going.
Was recently sequenced by a whole bunch of sperm. So, and highly heterozygous lines. I think Scott Hawley's is doing the same thing in blood. So, it should be possible to reconstruct it ongoing.
Yeah, whether one crossover between one pair demands it being only on that pair or another one. My guess is that it doesn't on the other arm. I don't think so. Of course, if it's sperm and Drosophila, then that's not going to tell us anything. Because they don't recombine.
Is there a titration effect that, that for example, if you overexpress SPO11, do you see more?
Oh, gosh. I don't know the answer to that question. I'll bet you people have done that kind of experiment. I mean, people are trying to sort of figure this out under the sort of rubric of crossover control. Is like, how do you? I mean, there was this crazy idea. Like, there were all these double strand breaks, and then yet you only get on average one chromosome, one crossover per arm. How do you get that? And this sort of has birthed this whole field called crossover control. And so, you know, presumably the particular one where SPO11 broke at a particular site gets licensed and says, okay, you go forward. But the details of that, to my knowledge, I haven't been to my ISS Gordon conference in a couple of years, so I don't know. Okay. So, back to this, because I wanted to at least get to this slide here. Okay, so this is now there. Okay, good. Yeah, this is like the second to last slide that I wanted to cover. This is Wilkins and Holliday's hypothesis. So they start with, and remember that the title of the paper is Meiosis for Mitosis. So they start with some early eukaryotic cells with mitotic division. Now, there's this question, think about it. You don't need to do meiosis unless you're diploid or higher, right? You just don't, you can't. You can't do it because you can't homolog pair. So you need to generate diploidy or higher. They talk about they basically discuss cell fusions and or endomitosis, et cetera. Homolog pairing they put in, and then, you know, and then they're talking about other things like enhancing recombination, adding in synapnemal complexes. I just showed you evidence that at least some of the proteins responsible for synapnemal complex are actually present at the last eukaryotic common ancestor, and then all this other stuff. So, the question is sort of what are the order of events that gave rise to it, and how do we figure it out?
And why would you evolve endomitosis to be associated with it? And it's not going to give you anything, right? Meiosis one.
Well, they got to get diploidy somehow. Sort of. They basically say endomitosis with a mistake. It does happen, yeah. Right. So they're trying to figure out how they get diploidy.
But what I'm saying is now you do meiosis and nothing happens. There's no
variation.
But if you persist for a long time after an endomitosis.
Yeah,
I guess. I mean, I think that's the thought.
I mean, a lot of the details of meiosis don't make sense with these maintenance theories that
exactly.
You presented.
Yeah.
If you really puzzle about these molecular details,
this
is what Mike was saying. If you have the endomitosis of pre-mitotic doubling, then you have time.
Then they're identical to start with.
You don't have any.
So you got to have endomitosis and then a long time to where the allelic copies are actually diverging from one another, and then you get some benefit later. So just that's sort of why I think why they kept in things like cell fusion, because you might imagine two lineages that are different enough to have diverged and they come together. So I'm sort of agnostic on this particular point. So that's their timeline. And now I'm going to leave everybody, and maybe people can talk to me about it in the few days that I'm left here. This is sort of how I've been thinking about it. So these are what I think of the prerequisites for meiosis and sex. So, and this gets to sort of the whole sort of origin of the eukaryotic cell business, which is actually really hard. So there's got to be a transition from circular to linear chromosomes because it just doesn't work with circular chromosomes. These are more or less in the order that I think they have to happen, but as I get farther along, I'm not sure. Obviously, we have to have a nucleus. Is it as we know it now? Does it have an envelope? Does it have, there has to be, so what the relationship between these two things, I'm not sure about. And then of course, we have to have some kind of centrosomal attachment thingies. And what kind are they? Are they nuclear envelope associated? Are they free? Shelly and I were talking about that yesterday. And I put mitosis next, right? So you got to get all these things to get this.
Why do you have to have a nucleus?
What's the point? I'm just saying, maybe not. Maybe you don't need a nucleus, but I think the idea is that with the linear chromosomes, you got to keep them somehow localized. But I might be wrong about that.
Remote
your bacteria within your chromosomes.
Well, I know that. But not bacteria with many multiples linear chromosomes and that are the size of eukaryotes, right? So.
And you can fix directly on the cell membrane instead of nucleus.
Fair enough. I mean, fair enough. I mean, again, I could put nucleus down here. This raises the question, you know. I mean, there's lots of scenarios of orders of origin.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about this last point. Nick, when you're playing next week. But so, in open mitosis, in most metazoans, they essentially don't have a nucleus at this time when they're doing mitosis or meiosis, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they have a nucleus and interface, but at the time when you're worried about chromosomes floating around or things like that, there is no.
I mean, maybe nucleus could evolve a lot later. I mean, we need to stick it in someplace. I mean, does it happen after the origin of mitosis and meiosis? I hope everybody bought the idea that meiosis had to come after mitosis, because I think it's just pretty clear. This one's important. We actually already talked about this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to do meiosis unless you have some way of changing your ploidy, either by some end of mitosis that persists or by some fusion. And then ability of cells to fuse here. So now I'm talking about haploid cells. So it has to be some way of getting them back together, that part that I said that I was going to talk about. So these things have to pre-exist before meiosis can be invented, in my view. And there might be some other things I've forgotten about, but these are sort of the prereqs. Like, to get into meiosis 400, you got to take, you know, 100, 200, and 300.
If you include in your table, you have this huge table of proteins in present neural nets, in which you, if you also include cell cycle proteins, do you also see some correlation?
So we generally haven't studied cell cycle proteins, in part because many of them are actually promiscuous and do other things, like kinases and stuff are sort of swapping between jobs in different lineages, for example. I mean, part of it is that I just haven't put them in, but a lot of them actually, that I at least early on was aware of, that they didn't have clear specified functions that were ancestral and, you know, could be compared amongst groups. But in general, cyclins, et cetera, are actually globally present where I know. So I guess part of the answer is, yeah, I think they're mostly globally present, but I haven't actually looked at them carefully.
Just wonder, even if you're in protein change, but if you are not regulated, then it still has no point to do meiosis.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, right, this has to be regulated in some way. It can't just be an arbitrary sort of blow up, blow down, blow up, blow down. I think that's what you're saying, right?
The sensing of your DNA.
Yeah. Well, of course, you have to have it in order for the machinery to sort of have something to work on. But for it to really work and do what we see it do now, it actually has to be regulated in some way. Yeah, maybe I should put regulated here. That's a good point. And I think I'm almost done, which is great. So how does this fit into the origin of eukaryotic cells? I'm pretty confident, as with Wilkins and Holliday, that meiosis had to have evolved from mitosis, which means it, you know, temporally had to come later, which means that, you know, are there organisms, you know, everything is present in the last common ancestor, in that quote that I gave, you know, so, but what about this, and I think this is words that people are using now, this first eukaryotic ancestor, FECA. What does that look like? So the first eukaryotic ancestor that wasn't an archaebacterium. And I think that's where a lot of discussion is happening, sort of where these orders of events are. And, you know, do we need to have the nucleus early in order to have these other things? That's actually, I think that's been inherent in our discussion and maybe just we hadn't thought about. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Yeah, well, that's just a fun slide. Let's do that just for fun. Okay, so I put this together as just sort of my test case. So people often ask, so prokaryotes do it. And so this is my way of sort of comparing the difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. So this is prokaryotic sex, if you will. Okay, each player has their own deck, and you know my two kids get together and they say, okay, do you have a, do you have a Pikachu card? Oh, I've got an extra one. I'm going to give you my Pikachu card, and now player two has a new gene. And so they're exchanging genes, sort of one or a few at a time. That's prokaryotic sex essentially. Okay. Compare that to eukaryotic sex, Pokemon style. They come with their decks, right? But instead of changing one card, they just throw them all together, shuffle them up, split them in half. It's not quite an exact analogy, but it works pretty well. So before you have these two separate decks, and now you got two different each player, and now of course those are the offspring. So it's very different, and it's this idea of sort of how do you think about it in the context of this maintenance of sex idea, because essentially you're just sort of mixing, it's all in. I think that still is an open question, is sort of how you get from that sort of one or a few things at a time versus the whole genome recombination.
Yeah, but like the whole resolution of the holiday structure, that could be easily resolved so that everything is recombinant, but it's not. You know, you have these isomers. If the thing, I forget all the words, but the way it isomerizes, you get a lot of chromosomes that just have basically a gene conversion event, not the swapping that linkage to equilibrium.
So is that a consequence of the molecular machinery that sometimes doesn't generate a crossover, and that's okay? I mean, if you ask meiosis people what crossovers are good for, all of them say to segregate chromosomes properly. They don't give a damn about whether it's creating recombinant joints or whether it's creating crossover joints. And I think to some extent they're right. When you ask about sort of what good is recombination, of course it's to, you know, is that it generates variation in populations. But it might be that for the most part, those are two outcomes that are okay. And my understanding, and Mike, you can correct me, is that it varies amongst organisms as to what the ratio of resolution between crossovers and gene conversions are. Very different across different organisms, the ratio of those two things.
But usually it's mostly just gene conversion.
Yes, right.
I mean, if the whole point of this is to do the good, bad, and the ugly, you wouldn't want to do that. You would always want to have recombinant chromosomes where what it, each, you know, is changed.
What about keeping good things together, though? I mean, that's the flip. That's the other sword. Maybe you don't always want to have to break things up. I mean, to me, it sort of tips on a balance both ways.
If you've got multiple chromosomes, if you've got 20 chromosomes, then you've got 19, 20 is the benefit of the combination without doing any crossover. So that kind of agrees with what you said, that the crossover doesn't really happen to cause recombination.
It doesn't always result in a molecular recombination,
right,
that's correct.
But it doesn't make much difference in terms of benefits of sex, because you've got lots of chromosomes in.
Well, there's an ongoing discussion about the benefits of sex by segregation only. So, you know, if you got many, many chromosomes, you actually can get a benefit of sex than if you have a few chromosomes, right? Because your segregational outcomes, if you got a lot of chromosomes, is exactly what you're saying, right? So you get some sort of recombination in the sense. You don't get recombination if you're linked, though. That's the problem. Then you're starting to think about, okay, so what are, and mitosis, of course, was a great way to handle multiple chromosomes, too. And meiosis can handle that, probably built in because it evolved from mitosis. But you still got to drop a crossover on every arm to segregate it properly in meiosis. And the organisms that don't do crossovers actually have a small number of chromosomes, like Drosophila males. Yeah. So these things are sort of push-me-pull-yous, depending on the biology of the organism.
So why does having a crossover help with the segregation?
Because when they line up, that's part of the setup of the spindle, so that, you know, so that basically you do that first division and you get that proper segregation, right? So if they aren't, the idea is that the crossover is maintaining the configuration at the metaphase plate, right? That's holding them together such that first division does this and separates the sisters like this. And if you aren't doing a floating around, and it might grab and split the centromere.
But it's unclear why you couldn't do recombination without crossing over. Right?
Fair enough. Right. Yeah.
Is it just difficult at the molecular level to control which way it's resolved? If you can control each junction, but it's sort of random, like which direction,
Well, one of the things is maybe you're starting to think about meiotic drive. So you could get one of the homologs sort of being more dominant in terms of, and these are usually
I was really thinking about that, just about whether it's
time.
Yeah, just difficult for a cell to control how many crossovers versus deconversions happen. Just if like you don't have like a huge protein directing like one arm of
I would say there's lots of variability among species with regard to that ratio, and I don't think we know the causes of those consequences. But there's certainly variation in nature with regard to those outcomes.
Okay, so let's thank John. That was great.